panel of scientists and policy experts moved their doomsday clock 30 seconds closer to midnight last week. The reasons? President Trump's rhetoric on nuclear weapons, a climate that continues to deteriorate, and a general lack of trust in the political establishment. Here's part of his first speech, President Trump's first speech to the United Nations General Assembly from September.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea.
We're spending this hour getting acquainted with the doomsday clock. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show. Theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss is chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board of Sponsors. He directs the Origins Project at Arizona State University, where he's a foundations professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and the Physics Department. Lawrence, welcome to the program.
It's nice to be on.
Well, who is the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and where does this doomsday clock come from?
Well, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists began shortly after the Manhattan Project and the development of the first atomic bomb. The scientists who were involved felt it necessary to begin to want to warn the world of the dangers of nuclear war and the dangers of nuclear weapons. And the Bulletin was created shortly after the Second World War. The board of sponsors of the Bulletin is a group of scientific advisors that was created initially in 1947, right around the time that the Doomsday Clock was created. It was the first chairs of it were Albert Einstein and Robert Oppenheimer. And for the last 71 years, they And the Doomsday Clock have appeared. The Doomsday Clock appeared on the cover of the Bulletin. The Bulletin was a magazine that was really meant to provide information to the public and to policymakers about nuclear weapons, so that people could know for the facts of nuclear weapons and therefore the dangers. And the clock was created as a symbol to demonstrate those dangers. And it was originally just a graphic image. Which was initially set at 7 minutes to midnight, and frankly, it was set initially because the artist thought that looked like a good position for it. But there was no literal basis for the 7 minutes to midnight, except for the fact that we now had nuclear weapons and the world was a more dangerous place. But over the last 71 years, the board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, the Science and Security Board, and the Board of Sponsors have met. Essentially each year to ask the question, is the world safer or less safe? Because initially of nuclear weapons, and about 10 years ago, a little more than 10 years ago, when I became chair of the Board of Sponsors, we also began to look at the other existential threats that technology had presented for humanity. And of course, one of the other major threats is climate change due to human-induced technology. But more recently, we've also begun to look at everything else, including bio threats, and then also cyber threats. Most recently, and we have moved the clock back and forth. And the closest it's been to midnight up till this year was 2 minutes to midnight in 1953, when the then Soviet Union exploded its first thermonuclear weapon. And now the arms race had begun. The United States and Russia were both in possession of thermonuclear bombs, hydrogen bombs, and were both essentially threatening each other. And at that, when that occurred, the clock moved up to 2 minutes to midnight. It's moved back and forth. It's been as far away as 17 minutes to midnight at the end of the Cold War, and in the last few years, it's been creeping up. It's been as far away recently as 7 minutes to midnight. Last year, right after the inauguration of Donald Trump, we moved it to 3 minutes to midnight. To 2.5 minutes to midnight. We moved it up 30 seconds, which is unprecedented. We never moved it by such a small amount. But we were very concerned by the rhetoric of then-candidate Donald Trump and newly inaugurated president. But because it was rhetoric, we felt action spoke louder than words, and we we moved it by a small amount, saying, well, we'll wait and see what happens in this year. And in this year, there's been a lot of developments, not just as that rhetoric turned into policy in some ways, that continued this provocative language, not just with North Korea, but with about the possible use of nuclear weapons in Europe. But U.S. policy has also been of concern. Just recently, and the nuclear posture review, which is done every 8 years, is for the United States, has argued that in some sense that this administration wants to build new nuclear weapons, smaller nuclear weapons, more quote unquote usable nuclear weapons. At the same time, North Korea, in the last year, as everyone knows, has clearly developed nuclear weapons and potentially is soon able to put them on a missile that might reach the United States. But the United States and Russia has also spoken provocatively and initiated various activities that are worrisome. And for the first time in over 50 years, the United States and Russia are not in the midst of high-level arms control agreements and to reduce nuclear weapons. And both Russia and the United States have talked about building new nuclear arsenals. So that's the nuclear front. But then at the climate change front, well, it's obvious, as people who follow the news, the United States has backed out of the Paris Accords, at least at a national level. Happily, locally and regionally, many states and counties are recognizing the need to fight climate change. But nevertheless, the world is not moving quickly towards what is necessary to reduce sort of catastrophic levels of temperature increase. And finally, on the emerging technology trend, one of our big concerns is the reduction of faith in democracy and in news and objective facts. If people can't trust the news that they see on the internet or elsewhere, then how can we effectively lead people to know what real threats are and what they aren't, and how can we sort of voters know effectively who to vote for? And so all of these things suggest the world is more dangerous, and so this year we moved it soberly, because we recognize the significance of this, to 2 minutes to midnight. So once again, it's at the closest it's ever been to midnight in the last 71 years.
Lawrence Krauss is with us. He is chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board of Sponsors. He directs the Origins Project at Arizona State University, where he is a foundations professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration in the Physics Department. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Have you paid attention to the doomsday clock over the years? How does it shape your interpretation of global events? Does the doomsday clock offer you comfort or concern? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Lawrence, you're taking these concrete political developments, influences in our world, and you're translating them to something that is abstract, to this doomsday clock. Is there much debate among scientists who try to set a time for this clock?
Yes, of course. Look, the first thing people should realize is it's not a scientific value in the sense that there's some mathematical formula that determines exactly what the clock value should be. What we do each year is we have a group of experts, of science and security experts, and the Board of Advisors, which contains 16 Nobel laureates, by the way, and spend a long time first educating ourselves of the situation. We have a symposium usually each year where we discuss the emerging threats, and then we try and come to a value. And as I often say, I think the absolute value of the doomsday clock, whether it's 2 minutes or 2.5 minutes to midnight, certainly, or three or whatever, is certainly subject to debate. But the really important question is, did we move the clock forward or backward? Is the world more dangerous this year than last year? And I think that's more unambiguous. And certainly there was more agreement about that. The absolute value, of course, is debated and discussed, and for weeks before we decided on a value. And let me just say, it's not just a doom and gloom kind of thing. What we're trying to do, The clock is a symbol, and a symbol which does, for better or worse, capture the interest of the world for at least a day when it's determined. There's literally thousands and thousands of news stories about it. And the point is to raise the profile of these issues and get the public discussing them, because we feel especially that governments are not leading in this case. And the way to affect change, the way to try and improve the situation, is for the public to get involved and express an interest. It's happened before. We've moved the doomsday clock back and in the past. And for example, when the non-proliferation treaty occurred, that was under when Nixon was president. Nixon wasn't a particularly peaceful, loving president, but he was influenced by the fact that there were mass demonstrations, that scientists and the public were concerned at the time about nuclear weapons testing. And that led the government to act. And we feel in many ways that the people of the world need to act. And by raising the specter of these threats, which we have to do, we feel, if people are going to act, before you can act, you have to know the situation. And then the rest of the year, by the way, the bulletin is a resource online for members of the public and policymakers, with not just opinion pieces, but expert pieces that describe the facts of the Iran nuclear weapons treaty, on the situation with North Korea. The first thing is to get people alerted. The second is to educate them. And hopefully the third is to spur people into action. And that's what we wanted to do. And that's why moving the clock forward is something we hope will spur public action, because many people, especially young people, have become complacent about issues, say, of nuclear weapons. In their lifetime, they've never been used. And the Cold War seems to have subsided. And the assumption is that among many people is that nuclear weapons are not an issue. Of course, North Korea has raised that specter, but we have to remember that the United States and Russia both have over 10,000 nuclear weapons still. And part of our obligation under the Non-Proliferation Treaty of the nuclear weapon states is to reduce our arsenals, and we're not doing that. We're not sending a message to the non-nuclear weapon states of the world, like North Korea and others.
Lawrence, I'm going to jump in here. Let's pause for a moment and let's go to Thomas in Milwaukee. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
My question really relates to whether all of this, which I would call borderline alarmism / fear-mongering, really is defeatist. And I understand Mr. Krause is very anti-Trump and sees everything sort of through that lens, up including saying that North Korea developed nuclear technology last year. Of course, that's the direct product of 20 years of American foreign policy, and specifically Obama, that allowed them to go nuclear. But beside the point, this kind of alarmist thing, whether it's climate change or Trump is Hitler, authoritarian, or the world going to end, is not helping what I would call the liberal progressive cause, because what it does is create these straw men that never appear. And reasonable people then look around and say, what were all these people talking about? Paul Krugman's crazy. The economy didn't crash. It's booming. But what is Lawrence Krauss talking about? The Koreas are talking. They're going to walk together during the Olympics. So when you go this far to, look, Trump is the devil and he's going to ruin the entire world, I wonder if, when that inevitably doesn't happen, if Al Gore's beachfront property isn't subsumed by water because of climate change, if reasonable people aren't totally justified in saying, why are these people fear-mongering?
Thomas, thanks for the call. Let's get Lawrence Krauss to respond. Lawrence, go ahead.
Well, look, there are always people who argue that this is fear-mongering, and so it's not an unreasonable question. The fact is, however, that we're not talking opinion. We're not saying Trump is. If you read the statement of the bulletin and if you watch the press conference and the bulletin statement is quite long, you'll see that we're talking about facts. The fact is, climate change is happening. The temperature of the world has increased by over a degree since the middle of the 20th century. The impacts are already occurring around the world. In fact, beachfront property, maybe not in the United States yet, is disappearing, although if you go to South Florida, you'll see it being flooded regularly. There are already impacts, severe impacts, on the rest of the world the impacts of potentially of more serious devastating storms are already occurring. These effects are already occurring. Climate change is happening. And right now we've gone 1 degree, but of the evidence is that if we don't do anything right now, we'll exceed 2, 3, or 4 degrees. The most the world has changed from the time the world went through a serious ice age to now is 5 degrees. This is extremely serious. And we are the only industrialized nation in the world whose government denies the reality of climate change. At the same time, right now, this government is talking about reneging on the Iran nuclear weapons treaty, which all experts argue is one of the things that has kept Iran from being a nuclear nation right now. Certainly, everyone, and I think everyone in the world, has recognized that with North Korea's testing of nuclear weapons and the provocative statements of both leaders, that the situation is extremely dangerous. In fact, Secretary William Perry, who was Secretary of Defense under Clinton, but has certainly been involved in defense for over 50 years, said, and I began my statement at the Doomsday Clock, he said, "Today the danger of some sort of nuclear catastrophe is greater than that during the Cold War, and most people are blissfully unaware of this danger." I think he has historical perspective. So I don't think you can always say that if we point out the dangers, that people are going to put their heads in the sand. But if we don't discuss the real dangers, then I think it's quite clear we're not likely to do anything about them. So in spite of the negative feelings you might have about pointing out these dangers, and I certainly hope that there are no nuclear weapons used against civilian countries, but if we don't point out the potential dangers, after all, look what happened in Hawaii just a little while ago with the false alarm. If that had gone to the United to the White House with a false alarm, we have 15 or 20 minutes to respond to the assumption of incoming nuclear weapons. And many times over the last 50 years, if you read, say, the book Command and Control by Eric Schlosser, you'll find we've come close to launching nuclear weapons.
Let's pause right there. The Bulletin of Atomic Scientists created the Doomsday Clock. We are learning about it. It was developed by researchers who helped build the first nuclear weapons during the Manhattan Project. That was the code name for the development of atomic bombs here in the U.S. during World War II. Today, the Bulletin Group is really worried about advancements in North Korea's military action. Theoretical physicist Lauren Krauss is with us. He chairs the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board of Sponsors, and he heads up the Origins Project at Arizona State University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does the Doomsday Clock shape your interpretation of global events? Does the Doomsday Clock offer you comfort or does it scare you? Join in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment. The Doomsday Clock was established at the start of the Cold War in 1945, and it's become a universally recognized metaphor. And last week, scientists moved it 30 seconds closer to midnight. It's a dire warning of the world's vulnerability to catastrophe from nuclear weapons, from climate change, from political instability. And some of that, it stems from comments like this one from President Trump in August.
Not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
We're learning the forces that have moved the clock closer to apocalypse on this Hour of the Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss is chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists and Board of Sponsors. He's a professor at Arizona State University. Your questions welcome about the Doomsday Clock at 800-642-1234. What do you think scientists should consider when setting the time? Are they taking stock of the right happenings around the globe? What would you add or eliminate from their calculation? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Joe now, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I've got two questions. One, was a doomsday clock advanced during Reagan's first year? And the second question has to do with during the Obama years, when things happened such as North Korea launching artillery attack against South Korea or threatening to establish a no-fly zone in Syria that would have involved shooting down Russian jets, possibly causing World War III. Where it looks like that, taking into account the advance of the doomsday clock, those things like ISIS arising in Libya due to Obama's foreign policies, those kind of things.
Joe, thanks for the call. Lawrence, go ahead.
You can go back. I'm actually now looking at through the list. During the Reagan era, the clock advanced from 7 minutes to midnight it went up through to 3 minutes to midnight, and then was moved back to 6 minutes to midnight. In 6 minutes to midnight, it was moved back when there was a historic intermediate range nuclear forces treaty. During the Obama period, the clock was first moved back because of the renewed emphasis at the time on arms control, but then was moved forward right through till 3 minutes to midnight at the end of the Obama period because of climate change and because of the rhetoric that occurred when Obama was elected, which caused us to move the clock back, wasn't really followed up because there wasn't the Congress working with the president did not work towards reducing nuclear weapons, as they said. So it's moved forward and backward during both those regimes. And I want to emphasize that to some extent, it also responds to the last question. This is not a liberal versus conservative question. These issues are not Democratic or Republican issues. These are issues of science, security, and safety of the world. So people should not assume, as often is claimed, that this is some group of left-wing liberal scientists who are trying to attack Trump or a Republican regime. Science and reality are issues that are independent of politics. And we try in a nonpartisan way, especially if you read the reports in the bulletin, to report on the facts, because science should not determine, and scientists should not determine public policy. But what we should do is inform public policy. And we can't make sensible public policy unless we know what the real issues are. And that's one of the reasons why we talk and are willing to talk realistically about dangers, because if you don't talk about them, you won't do anything about them.
But some people find that this doomsday clock is rather gimmicky, even though it's offering this tangible way for us to understand our proximity to worldwide devastation. How do you respond to that critique?
Well, of course it's gimmicky in a sense. It's a symbol. It's a symbol, a graphic symbol that happens to have captured the world from it's in movies and the point is, if we didn't do it, you and I probably wouldn't be having this discussion right now about the real issues. It's a hook to get the public discussion going. And anytime you do that in public, it's gimmicky. I write for newspapers all the time, for the New York Times and New York and other ones, but when editors determine the title for my pieces, they are gimmicky because they want people to read those pieces. When we write books, when we do anything, partly if you want to, as when I tell teachers that the greatest mistake you make if you're a teacher is to assume your students are interested in what you have to say. What you have to do is convince them to be interested. You have to talk about things that relate to them. So the doomsday clock is a hook that hopefully allows the initiation of public discussion of truly important issues. We hear, you know, the news is dominated by so many issues that seem peripheral from, you know, the bickering of political machinations to scandals going on in Congress. There are issues like climate change and nuclear weapons that are in the long term of vital importance and need to be discussed. And if we have to do a hook once a year to try and raise the profile of those issues, to have real serious discussions, I think it's worth it.
David tweeted and said, "What influence does politically motivated climate change denial have on the doomsday clock?"
It has great influence. The fact that as I say, this is the United States is the only major industrialized nation in the world where the party leading the government, in fact, the three branches of government from the White House and Congress and Senate denies the reality of climate change and that denial and that those efforts, if you look at in fact at what's been happening not just in rhetoric but in action mean, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Interior Department, the actions that are taking basically to try and step back and reduce the need to respond to what is a reality, what is a physical reality. It's not some liberal myth. It's a reality that climate change is occurring, that the temperature of the world is getting hotter, that the ice around the North Pole has been the lowest it's now ever been. Every year we see new impacts of that, and every year those impacts are serious. In fact, for example, they have other socio-political impacts. It's been argued that drought, for example, in Syria caused people to go from the country to the city, fomenting ultimately a Syrian civil war, and we've seen what's happening from that. I was just in Mexico, and if you look at the effects of drought there, it's been argued that between 6 and 14 million people over the next 20 years, due to drought and impacts on their agrarian economy, may be pressured to move north. So the same people who are worried about illegal immigration should be worried about climate change, because what's happening now is just a drop in the bucket. Over the next 40 years, if you look at perhaps 500 million people in low-lying areas in the mid-latitudes in the Pacific and elsewhere in Bangladesh, lose their land because of rising sea levels, well, that's the impact of that kind of refugee problem will dwarf anything we see now. These problems are real and need to be discussed.
Let's bring in Sam, who joins us from Door County. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. We're on climate again. So What I wanted to know is, how does the impact of, say, underground experiments like neutrino experiments that are taking place in the old underground mines, like in South Minnesota, et cetera, and the nations that are participating in weather influence, such as I know China just had a snowstorm recently that they basically generated. So how much of that is a factor that you would follow for things concerning the doomsday clock and climate change for, like, the experimentation that goes on in science?
Well, experimentation is a crucial part of figuring out how to effectively deal with things. Let me first disabuse you of worries about neutrino experiments in Sudan mine and in Minnesota and other ones in South Dakota. Those experiments don't affect anything. They accept fundamental knowledge. Neutrinos are elementary particles that are produced in the nuclear reactions that power the sun. They go right through the Earth without knowing the Earth was there. They're ethereal particles, and the experiments to detect them are incredibly difficult to do, but they have absolutely zero impact on the environment. All we're doing is detecting one neutrino interaction in thousands of tons of material every day. Those reactions are taking place, but they're not doing anything. So you don't have to worry about the neutrino experiments or experiments, say, at CERN. Those particle physics experiments are vital for our understanding the fundamental nature and structure of matter and the forces of that govern the world and our understanding of the origins of the universe, etc. But they don't have any direct impact on climate change. It's major human industrial activity that has such an impact. As far as experiments in the weather, I don't. The snowstorms recently that have occurred in various places are in the whole natural. But relating to this is a point that is important. People are talking about geoengineering as a way to address climate change, which is to basically considering putting artificial ingredients in the atmosphere that reflect or reduce the sunlight that's impacting upon the Earth to try and counter the greenhouse impact of carbon dioxide. That's a serious concern. It's important to understand what that might do to the environment, but it's one that's being discussed, and it may impact on climate in the future. And we need to have public discussions about those kind of artificial technological band-aids that are designed to address climate change. Now, they may be necessary, but we need to discuss their possible impact. And we also, of course, have to discuss the better way to deal with this, which is to ultimately not deal with the symptoms, but with the cause, which is human industrial activity, major the transportation, cars, industrial activity, coal mines in particular, and those things can be there. The important thing to point out is we do have the solutions. We have the technological solutions to all of these problems. In principle, the problems are political ones, and we need the political will to address them.
Sam, thank you for the call. And Lawrence Krauss, you mentioned CERN, which is the European Organization for Nuclear Research. It's a European research organization operating the largest particle physics laboratory in the world. Let's go to David now in Ironwood, Michigan. Hi, David.
Yeah. A few months ago, I was reading an article talking about some of the near misses in the United States, especially the one where that missile blew up in Arkansas, and the warhead actually ended out. Anyway, they essentially said that this one little switch, if it shorted it out, there would have been a nuclear explosion. I guess there was at least a dozen or so. Maybe you could go into it more. How many near misses? I guess some bomber was flying and a missile actually dropped in North Carolina. I mean, it's just none of them went off.
David, thank you for the call. David is wondering about when switches go wrong, when errors occur. Lawrence Krauss?
Well, this is the point, and I refer to the book Command and Control by Eric Schlosser, which is a wonderful book, which is terrifying, nevertheless, talking about the fact that we have not had a nuclear accident in one way or another in the last 70 years is remarkable and fortuitous. There have been so many close calls, not just in a wet missile silo in the south that was there basically a hammer drop that nearly caused a nuclear weapons explosion, but indeed, nuclear weapons have been accidentally dropped off planes in the United States, happily haven't gone off. But more than that, there have been numerous times where false alarms have gone off. And in fact, Secretary Perry talks about being wakened in the middle of the night when he was Secretary of Defense with a report that there were incoming missiles from Russia. And fortunately, it was demonstrated to be a computer error. A similar error, by the way, was happened in Russia, where, in fact, it was reported that the United States was launching nuclear weapons, and the order was given to launch nuclear weapons in response. And it was only an individual at a weapons silo in Russia who looked at this and said, this doesn't look like a real nuclear weapons strike, and basically disobeyed those orders that stopped the launching of nuclear weapons at that time. We are not safer by having more nuclear weapons. We are less safe. And we've had as many as 70,000. It's true they're now down as 10,000. We do not need 10,000 nuclear weapons. Many of these weapons on high alert, which means they're ready to respond in minutes. And by the way, one thing that's been made clear in the last since Trump's election, because people have been worried about this, is something that's been true all along. It's just that the United States has no mechanism to say no. The president has the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons, and if he or she decides to launch nuclear weapons right now, there's no group that can say, hold on, unless maybe it's someone at a missile silo who looks and says, this is not a good order. But these things are of great concern, and they're in some sense terrifying, and they're not fun to talk about. But we need to talk about them. We need to reduce our nuclear weapons arsenal. We're not safer by having so many nuclear weapons, and we certainly aren't safer by proposing building a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, which is what this administration is now proposing and has been proposed in Russia.
According to the timeline compiled by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the last time the doomsday clock showed humanity this close to total and utter annihilation was 1953. That was shortly after the U.S. decided to pursue the hydrogen bomb, which is a weapon far more powerful than any atomic bomb. The doomsday clock is now set at 2 minutes to midnight. We're talking about it this hour with the chair of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board of Sponsors. Lawrence Krauss directs the Origins Project at Arizona State University, where he's a foundation's professor. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. How should world leaders consider issues of climate change, of nuclear war? What questions do you have about the process used each year to set the doomsday clock? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll return to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. A group of scientists said last week that they think the world is as close as it has ever been to a so-called doomsday scenario. With that, they moved the so-called doomsday clock to 2 minutes to midnight. Since the 1940s, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has been tracking the threat posed by nuclear weapons and other forces, like in recent times, President Trump's heated rhetoric toward North Korea. This is what he said several months ago on the world stage.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
Theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss stays with us. He chairs the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board of Sponsors and heads up the Origins Project at Arizona State University. Getting your thoughts on the doomsday clock at 800-642-1234. Have you paid attention to the clock over the years? How does its time shape your interpretation of global events? Is it at all nerve-wracking that the clock is 2 minutes to midnight? Call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Bruce now, who joins us from Holman. Hi, Bruce.
Hello, good morning. I'm 68 years old, and I'm a child of the Cold War. I was born in 1950, and I think that there's basically two problems here. Problem number one is growing up during the height of the Cold War, including the Cuban Missile Crisis and all of that, the horrors of World War II and the use of nuclear weapons against Japan were still really fresh in people's minds. And as the decades have gone by, I think the horrors of what the use of nuclear weapons could mean has faded over time. That's one problem. People aren't as aware of what could happen. The second thing, since the climate change issue was brought up, I believe in the facts of climate change. And the problem I see with that is that it's a slow-motion disaster. It could take until the end of the century for really horrible predictions to be borne out. And if it was going to happen next year or in 5 years, if it was apparent that Florida was going to be underwater or, horrible, intense storms were going to continue and increase, obviously people would be jumping up and down demanding something will be done. But it's so far off in the future, most of the people that make the decisions, the politicians, the big business people, they're going to be dead and gone by the time it gets really, really bad. So on the one hand, people have forgotten the horrors of World War II and the use of nuclear weapons. And on the other hand, the horrors of climate change are so far off in the future that people just can't conceive of it.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Let's get Lawrence now to respond. Go ahead.
Well, I think I echo much of what you said. There's definitely a complacency for especially this generation who have not experienced publicly the immediate fears that people had who grew up during the Cold War, the Cuban Missile Crisis, or if you're old enough, as I am, to remember when kids used to have to go under their desks regularly to have these drills, assuming nuclear weapons would go off, not as if it would have helped. But that kind of recognition of that immediate danger was clear then, and it has subsided. And you're also absolutely right. Climate change is a long-term issue, and it's hard to get. It's well known that people respond to often immediate threats, often unduly, but long-term threats are harder to get people to respond to. They're slower. It's like the frog in boiling water. You sort of heat up slowly and slowly and slowly, and then you don't notice anything, and finally it's boiling. It's precisely because these effects are long term that we need to be concerned about them. Carbon in the atmosphere right now that has been produced over the last 100 years, over the last major period of human industrial activity, will remain in the atmosphere for 600 to 1,000 years. So this means that the longer we wait to address this issue, the more urgent the need to reduce carbon emissions is. And all of us who have children or grandchildren need to realize that this is a legacy we're leaving them. And if you're concerned about the world that your children or grandchildren will live in, then you should be concerned about climate change.
Bruce, thanks for the call. Lawrence, what would happen, what would need to happen to push the clock closer to midnight? What global events position us even closer to destruction?
Well, I think we talk about that as we did in the press conference and in the Bolton statement, the specific things that are necessary. We need to create institutions, first of all, that address this issue of cyber terrorism and false news across at an international level. Right now, there are no international institutions that are dealing with that. We need to maintain the Iran nuclear weapons treaty. We need to begin to have talks, bilateral or multilateral, between North Korea and the rest of the world. We need to begin to embark on arms controls treaties, real arms control treaties. There's many things that we can do to push the clock back. And I want to indicate, over the time that I've been chair of the board, the clock has moved in both directions. It's not as if we're always saying the world is getting more dangerous. We can take actions today to make the world safer, and we need to. What we're finding, however, is that at least the world's superpowers are not embarking seriously on the kind of negotiations that are necessary to reduce the threat of nuclear war, and the nations of the world, many of them are not acting seriously enough to address climate change and or develop real institutions that can recognize emerging threats from technology, be it cyber terrorism or bioterrorism. These things need to be dealt with, and we have, as I say, we have the technology, I think, to address most of these things. We need the political will to do it. So
let's go to Kirk now in Mauston. Hi, Kirk. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on. Dr. Krauss, thank you. I just want to thank you for all of the lectures you've given, all of the YouTube productions that you've given with other such luminaries as Dr. deGrasse Tyson, Dr. Dawkins. I just want to address what I've seen or what I think I've seen. Maybe you can help me understand. Maybe it's a problem of my perception, or actually it's an actual problem. So far, I see that we have only really dealt with symptomatic relief. I think that we need to disabuse ourselves of our culture of self-entitlement, this American way, without regard to consequence. Our lifestyle is suicidal. How do you recommend, what do you think of, to collectively educate and subsequently inoculate ourselves against this plague of disruptive ignorance, delusion, and political and economic destruction, all in the name of wealth extraction for a few? I like to cut straight to the bone.
Well, you know, it's a good question. I wish it was a single magic bullet. I'm an educator, and I write books, and there's an old expression, which is, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But I think education is a key part of it. What we need to do in the current world, part of this stems from, and one of the reasons why I write popular books on science, stems from the misperception that in school what we should be doing is teaching a bunch of facts, because there are more facts on my iPhone than you get in school, but there are more misfacts. What we have to do is train people, and young people, especially in this world of internet news, to be able to tell facts from nonsense. And that, to have a filter. And that means basically using the scientific method, teaching the students to ask questions, to critically examine the information they have, to be skeptical, to test their ideas, to look at many sources. These are the things we need now to inoculate ourselves against the misinformation that's happening. And I think these are the tools we need, what we need, and that will translate, hopefully, an informed public who are able to skeptically examine what they hear. We'll realize that what we need is evidence-based policymaking instead of policy-based evidence-making, which is what's happening now. And so I do think you're absolutely right. We need to go to drill down, ultimately, to where we educate young people in the 21st century to be able to skeptically examine the news and the information around them. And that's what we should be doing in school, teaching kids to question, to ask questions, and figure out how to get answers, really the basis of science. And so that's why, as a scientist, I'm not only interested in these issues from a policy perspective, but to educate people so that so that the next generation will be better capable of sifting through the nonsense they hear than the current generation is.
Lawrence Krauss, what can people do then in their everyday lives? They look at the doomsday clock and it's gloom and doom. What can everyday people do?
Well, one of the things that, as I say, the bulletin does is not just have this doomsday clock, but produce a real bulletin that provides information that people can access online about the realities of the issues you hear in the news. Not the opinion, but the realities of the Iran nuclear weapons agreement. So people first have an obligation in some sense to educate themselves on those issues, and then they can phone their Congress people. You know, Congress really does respond to public outcries. If a congressperson receives 5 phone calls on a subject in a given day, that's a large number. People can have an impact. They shouldn't feel impotent. So first, educate yourself. Secondly, write in your local papers, phone your congresspeople, form groups to talk about these things. Grassroots activism is important in this regard. And as I say, it's happened in the past, from ultimately forcing the U.S. to and other countries to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, to stop nuclear weapons testing. These things have worked in the past. And well, so people shouldn't feel impotent. Well, and, you know, and as I say, that's the, we haven't talked about my books, but that's the reason I write books, is hopefully so people can use them to educate themselves about many different issues.
Mike in Milwaukee is with us, and he's saying that this should be a nonpartisan issue. Party shouldn't matter when it comes to fixing all of the things that have been brought up this hour, but nonpartisan, being nonpartisan, kind of goes against how politics happens in America. This would be a shift in a different direction. Lawrence Krauss, is this possible very quickly as we wrap up?
Well, of course it's possible. It's happened in the past. But what we need to do is cut through the rhetoric and the propaganda and not accept the nonsense when politicians state it. What we need are official mechanisms to tie policy to reality, and many of those official mechanisms are absent. The public has to demand that. The public, in some sense, gets what they, I don't know whether they deserve, but what they act for. People have to vote. People have to express the fact that these issues are not liberal or Democrat or Republican, and when they're said to be that way, people have to speak out. This pseudo-partisanship that's occurring, the fact that people are claiming that climate change is a liberal issue, is very effective propaganda. And the only way to counteract propaganda is with knowledge. Speak truth to power.
Well, Lawrence, thank you so much for making time for us.
Well, thank you. It's an important issue, and I appreciate you having a whole hour on. Thank you.
Theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss chairs the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Board of Sponsors. He directs the Origins Project at Arizona State University, where he's a foundations professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and the Physics Department. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kedar Cherkent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.